Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
No, colonialism isn't over. It got replaced by this incredibly inequitable system of world trade and particularly tax havens. And I'm convinced that if people look at the real numbers, then the true story will win out over the false story. It may not look like it now, but you can't fool all the people all the time.
Multiple award-winning writer and journalist Sukhato Mehta argues the case for addressing global inequalities based on immigration as reparations. But first, here's a very quick roundup of tax justice news this month. Facebook's cryptocurrency proposal to launch for Libra is continuing to raise serious concerns around money laundering, consumer protection and financial stability. Some serious questions for governments to address. Yet again, a time for big government, not small government, considering this is a monopoly that already abuses its power in terms of customer data and tax dodging. And recently, the European Union called for the phasing out of so-called free ports in the European Union, or tax-free zones. Why? Well, they've turned out to be prime locations for hiding assets and dodging taxes. Guess what? Britain's new Prime Minister loves them, as do some of the private interests pushing a hard Brexit. Canada recently announced the results of its decision to invest in whistleblower awards. The Canadian Tax Authority set up an offshore tax informant programme in 2014 to track down tax cheats. They've paid out, since then, $1 million Canadian dollars and identified $50 million. They've recovered $19 million of that so far. Seems like a good return. We're going to talk to John Christensen now of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, so last month in the TaxCast we talked about how India was lighting a fire under the OECD and the G20 on international tax rules with their threat to go their own way on taxing multinational companies, since things aren't happening fast enough for them in terms of international agreements. Now, France has really annoyed the United States by voting through a digital tax, a 3% digital tax, which would obviously hit US multinationals like Google, Amazon, Facebook the most. And so we're seeing now President Trump threatening sanctions against France, but we're also seeing other countries coming forward with their own plans. It really does look like a collapse of the supposed international consensus on tax rules and which countries have the power to dominate those agreements. And it's pretty ironic as well that the United States is complaining bitterly that France's 3% digital tax is discriminatory because it only hits one French company, when the reason mainly US multinationals are the main ones affected in the first place is because they've been abusing a rigged tax system for years to kill off competition and capture the market. And, you know, they didn't mind exceptionalism then, but when the consequences start to bite, now they do.
Right. And if you listen to what French government officials, including the finance minister Bruno Le Maire, have been saying in the last few days, this is yet another fire being lit in an attempt to accelerate the pace of change away from the old order to a new order. They fully expected this fierce reaction from the White House, but they see this 3% tax on the large technical platform companies, as they refer to them, as a necessary step towards reasserting their own tax sovereignty. Firstly, so many of the big companies involved have taken really highly aggressive positions to cheat on taxes. Now, the second fact behind the French decision has to do with the market power, and that's something you were alluding to. Most of the really big tech platforms have monopoly power over their market niches, and this applies as much to Amazon as to Facebook and to Google. By their very existence, these monopolies can shape markets to their interests. They can charge above normal market prices for their services, they can block new entrants to the markets, and they can free ride of public services. The arrival of digital technologies and these gigantic digital platforms has massively disrupted the global economy, in some respects, of course, for the better, but they pose a huge threat to national sovereignty, both in terms of the ability of states to regulate them as monopolies, and in terms of exposing the need for new tax rules. So our hope, surely, is that President Macron and his finance minister, in imposing this 3% tax, will persuade other finance ministers, particularly the G7 finance ministers, who are meeting in Chantilly in just a few weeks' time. We hope that they will be persuaded to move faster and further towards creating new rules, not just for taxing the digital platforms, but for taxing all transnational companies.
Right, adding to the pressure. And as you say, it's not limited to the digital economy either, is it? Profit shifting by multinationals has really exploded since the 90s. The Tax Justice Network estimates $500 billion worth of revenue losses globally every year. IMF researchers say $600 billion. So it's a lot of money. But when France says it's imposing a 3% digital tax, it sounds a bit puny, but it's a tax on turnover, not profits. So, not puny.
Well, no, a tax on, essentially on a turnover in France, it'll raise something of the order of 500 million extra revenue. But I think the intention here is of France and of other countries is to move in the direction of a proper multilateral solution to a problem that's just been going on for decades and decades. In the last 50 years or so, multinational companies have come to dominate the global economy. Fewer than 400 multinational companies now dominate the global economy, and yet we haven't got a system in place to tax their income and to redistribute the wealth which they're accumulating. And this is causing huge instability, huge inequality. It's urgent, I mean truly urgent, that G7 finance ministers and others, especially finance ministers from developing countries, get round the table so that we don't have these gigantic monopolies accumulating huge wealth, which by and large is not being reinvested into the economy, creating new jobs. But it's urgent that we have a new tax order.
Right, and the OECD, if it is going to deliver, it's got a deadline by the end of 2020 to respond to this, probably their last chance to set the international tax rules. And really, they must sort out taxing rights on the basis of where actual real activity is taking place. Otherwise, we're going to see even more dramatic splintering with countries moving unilaterally and going their own way. Let's move on to shipping. And this month there's been high tensions with Iran near the Gulf, trying to impede a BP-owned oil tanker. They deny they were trying to seize it. The British Navy has helped to seize an oil tanker in Gibraltar coming from Iran on the way to Syria, accused of breaching sanctions. Most of, maybe all of these ships are sailing under flags of convenience. So the BP-owned tanker was sailing under an Isle of Man flag of convenience, and the Iranian ship was sailing under another flag of convenience. Now Iran has actually seized another ship. Events seem to be moving pretty fast there. One could and should ask, what's going on here? Because we've got expensive navies protecting ships which are privately owned and busy minimising their insurance and tax bills through these flags of convenience. Apparently, as a British territory, the Isle of Man contributes around £3 million a year to defence, while enabling companies like BP to attempt to minimise their taxes, therefore their contribution towards the costs of protecting them if and when it becomes necessary. The interesting thing here is the whole flag of convenience thing was a precursor to tax havenry.
Right, though I think if we delve back into the history, they more or less came through at a similar time, which is the 1920s. Look, any ship entering a foreign port or sailing in international waters must fly a maritime flag revealing the country of its registration. That's the registration of the vessel. So when we talk about a ship's flag, we're talking about the country of registration. But since the 1920s, when it was mainly American ship owners who'd become frustrated by trade union power on board the vessels and political attempts to improve crew's pay and working conditions, and also, it has to be said, to improve regulation of ships' safety standards and maintenance, some of these ship owners started to register their vessels in Panama. Panama, at that time, offered several things which ship owners found very attractive. First, the annual registration fee was small, just a few hundred dollars. Second, it allowed them to employ foreign crews at much lower wage rates and with far lower employment protections. Safety standards were lower, and to cap it all, the owners weren't obliged to be resident in Panama, and so they didn't pay any income tax. Furthermore, and the vast majority of shipping tonnage registered in Panama belonged to companies which were in fact registered in other jurisdictions like Cayman or British Virgin Islands or elsewhere, which meant that the identity of the real owners was kept secret. So, yes, Panama and other so-called flags of Caribbeans are just another kind of tax haven. By the 1950s, US ship owners were increasingly using flags of convenience, but they wanted to have more direct control over the registries. So American lawyers came up with the idea of a Liberian registry, ostensibly based in that West African state, but operated by a privately owned US corporation which administers the Liberian Maritime and Corporate Registry. Now, amazingly, this company, which is now the International Registries Incorporated, is located in Reston, Virginia, just a few kilometres away from the Liberian International Shipping and Company Registry, which is actually located in Washington, D.C. And so far, so strange. And you might ask, what does Liberia actually gain from these shenanigans? And the answer, sadly, is very little in practice. They gain an annual registration tax of less than a couple of $100s, and the agent's annual fee of around $300, but that's just about it. Now, as things stand, flags of convenience currently account for over half of the world's shipping tonnage, and that excludes warships. The big players are Panama, nearly one quarter of total tonnage, Liberia, the Marshall Islands, which is a US dependency, the Bahamas, which is, of course, is especially popular also with owners of big yachts, Malta, Cyprus. If this sounds a little bit similar to the tax haven model, it's because it is. It allows ship owners to take advantage of escaping tax, escaping regulation, whilst pretending to operate from elsewhere, Panama rather than the US, for example. Now, tiresomely, there is a British angle here as well, a Brexit angle, if you will. Private Eye is reporting in its latest edition that the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency in Britain, which runs the UK registry, is changing the registry rules to remove the previous limitations, which used to restrict ownership to being UK resident owners or residents of another European Union country. Now owners in Commonwealth countries, plus another 20 countries around the world, including China, Japan, the United States, even the Marshall Islands, will be able to join the UK registry. This looks like yet another ratcheting down of regulatory standards in Britain and in Britain's post-Brexit development strategy.
It's all a great demonstration, I think, of how capital and private interests have no borders themselves, and they can behave as though they're territory-less, you know, citizens of the world, citizens of nowhere, while so many other ordinary people are trapped in terms of freedom of movement, depending on what country they were born in, what passport they hold. And the hypocrisy is all the more staggering, really, when you think that private interests are very quick to manipulate borders and fear of immigrants when it suits them. Brexit is a perfect example, where closing borders and stopping freedom of movement of ordinary people has been the main card that they've played. Plus this idea of sovereignty and taking back control, and silly stories about Britain's glorious past, when in fact those private interests don't care one jot about borders and territories or immigration. They've funded what's basically a business proposition, and the purpose really is delivering the UK market belly up to the United States. Overriding sovereignty is exactly what they're all about.
Yeah, now if you go back to the origins of the current period of globalisation in the 1970s and 1980s, the buzzword at that time was freedom. And what they meant was actually freedom for capital to cross borders, go wherever it wanted. They were never actually advocating complete freedom of movement for labour. And that's what we've got. We've ended up with freedom of movement of capital. African capital can move northwards into Europe, but African labour can't. And that's created gigantic contradictions. At the Tax Justice Network, we talk about tax havens as providing an escape from tax and regulation. And in practice, what this means is that transnational corporations and the very, very rich people can simply sidestep their obligations. They can move their capital wherever they want. They can operate completely outside the framework of laws and rules that democratic states have created over the last 70 years. Now, it took in the case, if we look at the shipping thing, it took decades for American sailors to organise themselves into trade unions and to bring their collective bargaining power to bear on policymakers in Washington in order to secure better wages and better working conditions. And then the ship owners went offshore to use flags of convenience, and employment standards and shipping ship safety standards fell through the floor. And that's what's been happening more generally now in the current era of globalisation. Since the 80s, the capitalist class, if you will, has become truly globalised. It largely operates offshore. It cooperates, they cooperate amongst themselves very, and particularly the banks, they cooperate extensively amongst themselves. They employ armies of lobbyists to promote freedom of movement for capital, because they know that free movement largely places it outside the tax sovereignty of nation states. And it can use its freedom of movement to push governments to give it yet more tax breaks and even lower standards of regulation. If we want to restore control over rampant capitalism and rampant tax havens and rampant tax avoidance, this race to the bottom of regulation, we'll need new rules, new tax rules, for example, at a global and regional level. And that means more international cooperation, not less.
Thanks, John. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. We're always saying on the TaxCast that corruption is seen through completely the wrong end of the telescope. We've always criticised Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index because it does nothing to advance our understanding of the way the world is structured to ensure the supremacy of some countries over others, in the past and today. That's why the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index and the Corporate Tax Haven Index are so important. They're evidence-based, and there are no perceptions involved whatsoever. These are cold, hard facts. There are many things which must change to abolish the structural blocks to human progress in terms of trade agreements, international tax rules, and ending financial secrecy. But one of the fastest ways to address inequality is almost never discussed: immigration. I'm really pleased to have with me today multiple award-winning writer and associate professor at New York University, Sukhatu Mehta. He recently released his latest book in the United States called This Land Is Our Land, An Immigrant's Manifesto. He'll release a UK version of his book in August 2019. We started by talking about the responses to his new book. Here's Sukhatu Mehta.
Look, colonialism was in the past. Get over it. You had enough time to stand or fall on your own. No, colonialism isn't over. It got replaced by this incredibly inequitable system of world trade and particularly tax havens. You know, we have a second British Empire right now. These nations of the world are actually providing aid to Britain and America and the EU. These countries have been forced to open up their markets under the threat of tariffs to Western multinationals. The multinationals have gone in and they're paying much less than their fair share of the taxes they ought to because of this insane system of tax havens around the world. There's a giant transfer upwards and it has real and significant effects on these countries. I mean, it's not just taxes, it's also the way that multinationals go into these countries and flout every labor and environmental law that they can. We have this system of global corporate colonialism, which is actually as exploitative as the crown colonialism that is replaced.
Yes, I was really excited about your book because it's the first time I've seen somebody bringing together reparations, migration, tax and the environment all in one place, which is really where they belong. And it's no accident that these inequalities between nations exist and this progress or lack of progress economically. And it's interesting the way that you frame it in terms of the bill that needs to be paid. Can we break down how you see that bill that has been run up, first of all?
So the bill has four parts: appetizer, main course, side dish, and dessert. And the main course really is colonialism. The figures are just incredibly startling. During the colonial period, the European share of world GDP went from 20% to 60%. When the British came to India at the beginning of the 18th century, India's share of world GDP was 23%. By 1947, when the British left, it was under 4%. So basically, the colonial empires were not run for the benefit of the colonized. It wasn't really about saving souls or giving people the railways. It was about looting these countries wholesale so that the colonial powers could build up their countries, their cities. What I say in my book is that people are moving not because they hate their homes or their language or their communities, but because they have no choice. Because first of all, when these countries were colonized, when the colonialists left, they left these countries bankrupt and desperate. And they drew maps in a way which ensured permanent strife between the communities that they had left behind. The second part of the reason people migrate is that when the colonialists left, they didn't stop exploiting these countries. Colonialism turned into corporate colonialism. If you go to any small African country and you go to the, you know, the fanciest hotel in the capital, the Hilton or the Sheraton or the Ritz-Carlton, you'll see these small groups of white men drinking with the local elites, the local generals, the local presidents, jointly plotting how to rip off these countries. Developing countries lose 3 times as much to tax havens as the foreign aid that they receive. 40% of multinational profits are immediately moved to tax havens. The UK and its territories alone hold £1.4 trillion of tax evading money. And I saw this myself because my book isn't just about numbers, it's about stories. So I traveled all over the world speaking to migrants about why they were fleeing. And I remember being in Tangier in Morocco last year. And I met a young Guinean family, a young mother and father and a newborn baby. And they were going to cross the Mediterranean in a tiny boat, like a plastic dinghy, not even a lifeboat. They were going to try to get to Europe because there was no life possible for them in Guinea. And then I made the connections. Guinea-Conakry has up to half the world's bauxite, but most of it's controlled by an American hedge fund named Oxif, which, according to a US government report, bribed Guinean officials to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. And it's paid hundreds of millions of dollars in fines, not to Guinea, but to the US government for corrupt practices in Africa. The head of the hedge fund, he's bought an apartment in New York in a building where apartments go for $250 million. But he had enough money. He didn't have to sell one of his previous apartments. He kept another penthouse, which cost $100 million. Another man associated with this hedge fund bought a 900-acre estate in the English countryside. Every year, $150 billion leaves Africa alone for tax havens. So when the colonizers left, they left their agents behind, the local elites, and they periodically go in to take what they want. They continued exploiting these countries. The third element of why people migrate is war. The United States launched an illegal and unnecessary war in Iraq after 9/11, and it set the entire region ablaze. We're still feeling the ramifications of that massive folly, that massive lie, where the United States claimed that there were weapons of mass destruction, and of course, none of them existed. 600,000 Iraqis lost their lives as a result of that colossal blunder. And it's not just the big wars, it's the traffic in guns. The United States put in 1.8 million guns in the country of Honduras to arm the Contras during the Nicaraguan conflict. 75% of the guns in Mexico and 98% of the guns in the Bahamas come from the United States. So we, the United States, we arm the local drug cartels. In fact, we emptied our prisons in the 1980s and deported some of the most heinous criminals to these countries, which formed gangs like MS-13. These countries have been devastated through guns and through American interference in Central America. And we buy the one product they have left to sell, which is their drugs. So that's the third element. And the fourth, and potentially the biggest, is climate change. By the middle of the century, up to 1 billion people are going to be displaced by climate change. By the middle of the century, land that is home to 650 million people will be underwater, and 30% of Earth will be desert. Who's responsible? The United States is 4% of the world's population, but put one-third of the excess carbon in the atmosphere. The EU, of which Britain is still part, another quarter. The average American uses as much energy as 35 Indians or 185 Ethiopians. So these countries, the West, built up their economies and in the process emitted most of the carbon that's in the atmosphere. And the people who are paying, whose lands are getting flooded, who can't grow anything on their farms, they are the poorest and they're paying the price. So what I am calling for is immigration as reparations. The West stole the future of poor countries. And now there are these desperate and starving masses, and they want to come to the West, not to invade and conquer and loot and pillage, but to work.
Right, right. And you talk about quotas based on how much wealthy countries have ruined other countries and killed their futures. I know that you prefer open borders to quotas, but I wonder if you can tell me a bit about how those quotas might work.
I believe that countries are responsible for their history, just like individual human beings are responsible for the crimes they commit. So the kind of people they let in, if there are to be immigration quotas, and you know, ideally there would be something much more along the lines of open borders, but if we are to have quotas for who comes in, it shouldn't be based on what immigrants can contribute to the host country, although immigrants contribute immeasurably to these countries. But it should be based on how much these countries have despoiled other countries. So Britain should be letting in large numbers of Indians. France should be letting in large numbers of Algerians and Moroccans. Spain should be letting in large numbers of Latin Americans. The US right now is in the midst of a big debate about what kinds of immigrants to let in. And even the Republicans realize that unless America lets in immigrants, the country is sunk. It's just not making enough babies. The only people who can save this sinking ship are immigrants. So now there's a proposal to let in skilled immigrants. So my group, the Indians, you know, are considered ideal, the kind of immigrants that America wants. But it's not my group that America has hurt most. It's the Latinos. It's the Central Americans. In country after country, decade after decade, they've destroyed any hope of democratic reform. They've toppled democratically elected leaders and installed America-friendly despots. So America, if there were any natural justice, if there are to be immigration quotas, should be letting in Dominicans and Guatemalans and Hondurans and Salvadorans. So that's what I'm calling for. Immigration as reparations, and also a kind of, you know, paying the bill for what these countries have done to others. So, you know, so to take that paying the bill metaphor, if Americans go out and eat at a Salvadoran restaurant, then they shouldn't be paying the bill in the Indian restaurant that's next door.
Right. And you make the point, which is really interesting, is that what might be seen in the world would be a large mass movement of people, and then that would decrease naturally. The whole point of all this is that this is the fastest way to redress inequalities that have been perpetrated by the host countries.
Exactly. So remittances are the best and the most targeted way of helping the global poor. You look at immigrants anywhere, in any country. Most of what they do is just they work brutally hard so that they can send money back to their families. They're ordinary heroes, these immigrants. You look at the least skilled of them make tiny amounts of money. They have almost no disposable income. Send money back to their mother, to their sister, to their children, you know, to educate their family, to help with medical treatment. Remittances, the figures are just staggering about how much they pay. Last year, migrants sent back $689 billion in remittances, three times more than the direct gains from abolishing all trade barriers, four times more than all the foreign aid, and 100 times more than all the debt relief in the world. So if you had more open borders, migration is like the weather. There are areas of low pressure and areas of high pressure. And people will move from areas of high pressure to areas of low pressure, right? So when people move from a poor country to a rich country and they start sending money back, And if you let in more of the people from the poor country, as more money goes back, that imbalance is redressed and more people can afford to stay home. Most migrants don't want to leave home. You know, they might want to visit Piccadilly Circus or see the Eiffel Tower, but then like most tourists, they want to go back home. Let's give them that choice. And more open borders, a more equitable flow of money across borders, and remittances and migration are the best way to redress those imbalances.
Right, and highly beneficial for the United States and Britain, for example, as well. Beneficial to their economy, well, and also to their society, but that's a whole other question, I guess.
Yes, so without immigration, America's economic growth would have been 15% lower in the recent past. So from 1990 to 2014, the United States economic growth would have been 15% lower. Britain's would have been a full 20% lower, and Southern Europe's would have been 30% lower. You know, study after study have demonstrated if you let in more immigrants, your GDP is going to go up because immigrants work harder and longer. Immigrants are 14% of the American population, but we started a quarter of all new businesses, and we've earned over a third of all the Science American Nobel Prizes. One of four U.S. tech companies has had an immigrant founder. I mean, the figures just go on, and it's the same statistics in Britain and across Europe. When you let immigrants in, it's better for the economy, both in terms of low-skilled and high-skilled workers. Now, there might be some temporary effects on the lowest-skilled workers when, you know, there's a lot of immigrants coming in all at once to do unskilled jobs. But then the solution isn't to keep the unskilled out. It's to train the native born and give them more skills so that they can go up the economic ladder. And it's also to reduce the immediate costs of migration by taxing the corporations that benefit from immigration, taxing, for example, the tech companies and redistributing some of that money. So there are intelligent ways of dealing with migration. But, you know, this fear that Europe and America have of a massive influx, and there are people on the right who are saying, well, we're not against immigration, but we don't want this huge wave of immigration. That is nonsense. During the 19th century era of mass migration, a quarter of Europe moved to the United States. And what happened? The U.S. replaced Europe at the pinnacle of world power and wealth. So there's absolutely no evidence that these countries can't take in multiple times the migrants that they are right now. Canada, in fact, wants to triple its immigration intake. It's actually hired a consulting company to show it how they can bring in even more immigrants. These are cold countries that need warm bodies.
Yes, yeah. It's ironic because on the one hand, it's never been more important to make these arguments. And on the other hand, it's never been a worse time, you could argue, to try to make these arguments in the United States, in Britain as well. A lot of things have been happening about the stories we tell ourselves about our nations and our histories, which are going in exactly the opposite way of recognising the reality of history and our responsibility for it.
That's why I wrote what might turn out to be a highly unpopular book. That's the way you fight the populists, by writing an unpopular book. Look, you know, there's a giant contest of storytelling around the world. Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage are telling a story. Trump is telling a story. Duterte in the Philippines is telling a story. Bolsonaro in Brazil is telling a story. Modi in India is telling a story. Erdogan in Turkey is telling a story. Orban in Hungary is telling a story. They are false stories, well told. What is a populist but a gifted storyteller? And the way you take on a populist is by telling a true story better. I spend an enormous amount of time gathering the statistics that back up my stories. And I'm convinced that if people look at the real numbers, then the true story will win out over the false story. It may not look like it now, but you can't fool all the people all the time. Even in these countries, you see that the places where people are against immigrants tend to be in the places where people don't have everyday lived experience of immigrants. the fear of migrants is doing incalculably more damage to the West than the migrants ever could. Exhibit A is Brexit, the biggest own goal in British history. And Britons are coming to realize that, you know, there are multiple studies and polls which show that Brexit came to power on a wave of xenophobia, that there were people in rural England who just didn't like foreigners and didn't know foreigners. Most of London voted to remain in the EU. So where people meet immigrants every day, New York, for example, where 2 out of 3 residents are immigrants or their children, it's an incredibly pro-immigrant city, and it's never been richer or safer. I hope my book reaches out and that, you know, some of this message gets there. But I'm under no illusions. There already is a huge backlash against my book in the US. It's just come out here, and I've been getting all kinds of death threats on social media. But you know what? My book is also ammunition for people who know that the immigration story is a good news story. I'm convinced as the West realizes that these populists who came to power to attack immigrants, their next target is going to be in their country. Women, gays, leftists, journalists, most of all, the populists hate storytellers. They hate journalists. They hate writers, because we are the one thing, the one group that can actually fight them story for story. You know, all we can do is not be silenced.
You've been listening to Sukhothu Mehta on the TaxCast. I strongly urge TaxCast listeners to read his book, This Land is Our Land, An Immigrant's Manifesto. It's published in the United States by Macmillan. The UK version will be published in August 2019. Full details on www.sukhothumehta.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.